Some of it is in preparation for tomorrow's meeting. Honorable Zandamela does not have documents. Honorable Nisa, Honorable Mola. Anyone else? No. Can we just ensure members get documents, please?
Sure.
I'll wait a minute just so that everybody gets it.
Yeah.
But I think, honourable members, let me continue speaking to the agenda. Essentially, honourable members, tomorrow you're aware that we're meeting with the Department of Police in relation to the firearms amnesty. We're also meeting with the Department of Defence in relation to a briefing on the hydrographic bomb. So part of today's meeting, we'll get a briefing by our researcher and content advisor in relation to the two issues. The third issue that we're going to deal with in today's meeting is a briefing by our legal advisors on the court judgment concerning the removal of Advocate Jiva from office by the President. So, honourable members, the agenda should be in front of you. We're actually going to take the briefing by the legal advisors first. The reason we put it second in the agenda was based on the potential availability. But given the fact that they're available now, we'll actually attend to that matter now. And their briefing is in relation to the case, Jiva's case, which was dismissed in the High Court on the 18th of October. But all members will remember that the last time we met on this matter was on the 20th of August. And this was in the context of her court application to interdict Parliament. So there have been other processes that took place in between our previous meeting and the court issue, as well as the... So I think legal services will actually then take us through all these processes up to the court, the dismissal in the High Court, that issue, as well as what the implications are for Parliament's process. I'm going to... Maybe firstly welcome the two members from legal services. We have Siviwe Njikele, and we have Saloshni Ganga. Ganga. Okay. Welcome members from legal services. Let me hand over then to you, Mr. Njikele, to take us through. Thereafter, we'll then get members to. Sorry.
No, taking it to place for
yeah. I think I mentioned we adjusting the agenda. Okay. Do you want to follow us?
Yeah, I just want to raise something, Chair.
Sure.
I know. I'm raising this thing to you as the chairperson of this committee.
Mm-hmm.
And you know for a fact that yesterday we were supposed to go to Mpumalanga. Yes, I know what I'm raising now is not in the agenda.
Okay.
But I was very I don't know how to put
oriented.
Yeah. About what happened yesterday. We knew a week ago that we must go to Mpumalanga. And yesterday I was stuck in the province there without arrangement. This is totally unacceptable. I'm sure it was reported to you. I just want to raise it. Thank you.
And now it's fine, Honourable Zandamela, you don't need a formal meeting to raise such a discontent, but I am aware of what has happened. In actual fact, from our side as well, we were trying to do follow-up with the chair of the NCO, the house chair's office.
But I'm raising
Yes. No, it's fine, but I'm just saying in future... You can raise it in the meeting because today's meeting is happening immediately after yesterday.
But
I'm just saying, all members, some things are be outside of my office as the chair. We need certain authorizations for certain administrative processes. We've been trying as much as we can from our side to get the proper authorization. And our apologies to you, Honorable Zandamora.
No, I'm
apologizing from my side as the chair, but I cannot justify why you had to come or not. You were frustrated in your own province yesterday. Right, but on members, we still don't have authorization. No, we still don't have authorization for our trips in terms of the Section 76 bill. We're still following up as an office. So please bear with us. So we're trying to do as much as we can.
We'll talk about it after
the that's what I wanted. but let me then hand over to Mr. Njikele to take us through. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to members of the committee. Chair, the committee will recall that we had an urgent application in August by Advocate Jiba. The application was in response to the letter that Parliament had written to her, inviting her to make representation on why she should or should not be restored in her office. The application was filed. An agreement was reached between the parties. By parties, I mean Parliament, I mean the Presidency and the Ministry of Justice, and the National Director of Public Prosecution. We agreed on the time frames for the conduct of the litigation. Of importance was that we agreed that we are going to the hearing of the matter on the 19th of September. All the court papers were filed by all the parties. Parliament decided not to oppose the application by Advocate Chiba and opted to file a notice to abide, but with an explanatory affidavit. In our explanatory affidavit, we sought to explain why we had adopted the position that we adopted as Parliament. You will remember the position we adopted was that we are not going to stop voluntarily because they have requested it. We felt that this is a statutory obligation. We will only be stopped by a court process. And we wrote to them saying exactly that, and they decided to go to court. And both committees at the time decided that they will allow that court process, hence the agreement that we should go to court on the 19th. Of September. On the 19th of September, we were in court, the matter was argued, and the judgment was reserved. And then the judgment was delivered only on the 18th of October. Now, the judgment has dismissed the application. You will remember in Advocate Jiba's application, there were two parts. Part A sought a reinstatement to her office. They sought a declarator that the president's decision to remove her was unconstitutional and therefore she must be reinstated with all the associated benefits. But in paragraph 5 of that notice of motion, they sought an order to stay the parliamentary process which the committees had begun at the time. So we went to court, we argued the matter. The issues that were raised, firstly, in opposition was that the nature of the order they are seeking with regard to the president's decision, although it's couched in interim terms, but in practice it was a final order. And on that basis the presidency and the Minister of Justice were opposing that you have deceptively put together this notice of motion as if you are seeking an interim order. Because if you are saying the decision of the president to remove you is unconstitutional, how is that interim? It's a final order. So on that basis, it was opposed. But they joined, they took our argument, and they said, in respect to paragraph 5, Parliament is under a statutory obligation to get on with the business, as required by Section 12.6. And indeed, in the judgment, the court agrees with all those points, that it's not an interim order, it has final effect, and that Parliament is required by legislation to deal with this matter expeditiously. And for that reason, the application in as far as Part A was dismissed in its entirety, with costs. Now, the question is, what does this mean for the institution now? Chair, we are of the view that, in the sense that the application was dismissed, in particular the interdict they sought was dismissed, there is no legal impediment that prevents Parliament from proceeding with this process. And we just came from the portfolio committee, because I need to be able to take you into some sort of confidence with the discussions that are taking place there. We have received some information that there may be an appeal against this judgment. Now, of course, the question is, if there is indeed an appeal, what does it mean for Parliament? Should Parliament wait for that appeal process to be finalized? Chair, we hold the view that there is nothing in law that prevents Parliament from proceeding, because they have failed to obtain the interdict. 19 September was meant to decide whether Parliament should be interdicted. They have failed to obtain that. The judge did not agree with them. So legally speaking, there is no interdict. Parliament can proceed to consider the matter and go through its process, because we haven't even received the appeal. We are just getting the rumors that there may be an appeal coming, which we do not doubt. In circumstances like this, people tend to go on appeal, even if it's just to drag the issue. So we have no doubt that there will be an appeal, but legally speaking, as we are speaking today, there is no appeal. And therefore, Parliament is free to proceed with its processes. Now, if the committee decides to proceed with the parliamentary process that it had initiated, the question is, how do you go about that? What I mean by that is, you had already written to Advocate Jila and gave her 10 working days to make the presentation to the committee. The question that comes up as a result of this process is whether you now proceed on the basis of that notice, or you issue a new notice giving her additional time to make the presentation in view of the fact that she has now failed to stop the process. There was quite a discussion in the portfolio committee on whether this is necessary. There were views that we have already given that platform. She decided not to utilize it. Our view, Chair, and we're not imposing this on the committee, it's something that the committee should consider, that we have already, as Parliament, decided to stop the process in view of the pending Part A. It seems to us, if you want to follow through on the issue of fairness, it seems to us it will make sense for you to give her the time to make the presentation. Whether you give her the full 10 days or you set up a truncated period is up to the committee. But I can share with you that in the discussions on the portfolio committee, they have decided on a shortened period, because they said, we have already notified you, you are already aware of what the issues are. In the interest of us being expeditious in dealing with the matter, we will give you a lesser period than what we had originally given to you. So that is the issue that the committee must consider. And of course, you will remember, Chair, that one of the issues that was raised in the application was the issue that she is out of a job, and therefore she does not have the funds to make the presentation to the committee as per the letter that we had written. Now we know for a fact that the National Director of Public Prosecution had written a letter to her where they said they will fund that legal representation before the committees. Now, of course, there is a problem with legal representation because that's how they have couched it. Ordinarily, Parliament does not allow legal representation. It allows legal assistance. In other words, you can consult with a lawyer. He or she can assist you in drafting the representation. But the person who appears before the committee, if the committee feels that there is a need for an appearance, it's you as the person, not the lawyer who is going to make arguments. So in as much as they have that legal representation from the National Director of Public Prosecution, and they've got the funding and all of those, but there is that issue, we suspect that the issue is going to come up as to whether she's entitled to legal representation before that. But Chair, I think today we just want to focus on what has to happen now. And I don't want to go into other issues. In our view, nothing stops the committee from proceeding. The committee has a discretion to decide if there is an appeal, to wait for that appeal to be finalized. But as we know with court processes, that will be a long time to wait for an appeal, because we don't know whether it's going to go to the full bench in the Western Cape or it's going to the Supreme Court of Appeal. That all of that has an implication on how much time it takes for that matter to be decided on appeal. I think, Chair, for now, I will stop there.
Thank you, Mr. Njike. All members, we've received the legal briefing and advice. I'm going to open it up for questions of clarity if anything is unclear before we move to we discuss the way forward. Are there any members who want to raise any issue?
Except to comment.
Honourable Bill?
No.
I'm saying for me it's not a question, but it is for this committee to find a way in which we will expedite this matter. This matter is of national importance. It has been in the public domain for a very long time. It has some implications to the whole criminal justice system, and the sooner it's concluded by Parliament in terms of Section 12, the better. Now, my view is that we need to proceed. I understand the legal opinion is that we, in a way of affording her a fair opportunity, we must also give her an opportunity to submit to us a written submission about why we should not finalize this issue in the way that we've got to finalize, and why we should not agree with the president on her dismissal. My view is that let's finalize this matter. If we are to give some way, it should be 72 hours. Should be some 72 hours if we are to do that. My view is that we are ready. We've given an ample opportunity to legal representation, to written submission to us, and this matter is ripe. I think it ought to come to the committee so that it reaches finality from that point of view. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Nicolakis.
Thank you, Chair. My question is just, I believe the Portfolio Committee has given an extra 7 days. What would the implication be if the Select Committee decides on a different time frame? I mean, if the Select Committee, for argument's sake, says, okay, you've got 3 days, but the Portfolio Committee gave her 7 days. What is the implication of that? Because effectively then she has 3 days and not seven. So I just want to know how that would work in practice if we differ in terms of the time frame given between the two houses. Thank you.
Yeah, I think there would be then a lack of consistency in terms of procedure. And perhaps we should just bear that in mind as we continue discussing the matter. Honourable Greer?
No, thanks, Chair. In fact, I was going to make a proposal that we give her the equal time that the NA has given her, so that our process run concurrently, and also we are seen to be consistent as the two houses. So I propose that we give her the 7 days, but also looking at this judgment in terms of paragraph 72, where it says the court would intrude upon oversight function of parliament, which it generally has in terms of section 55 of the constitution, blah, 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 which then says that even if there is an appeal, we can still proceed. That's the implication of that paragraph 72. That we can still proceed. That's how I'm interpreting that section 72. I mean that paragraph 72. That we can still proceed with the matter, even if she decides to appeal. So in the event she decides not to make those submissions, we can still proceed after the 7 days and do our processes and set them aside. So that as and when she loses it again at the level of appeal, then we are already done with our processes. We just release the outcome. So I should think that should be the approach, that this time around we proceed. We're not delayed by, because some of the people, especially these people who are legally equipped, they know how to delay some of the processes. Some processes that are inevitable, but they would delay them forever. So we shouldn't be find ourselves in that situation. Thanks, Chair.
Thanks, Chair. I think I'm in agreement with those that saying we should proceed. But I think my mind slipped somehow in your presentation. You have spoken about her not having financial muscle to come and account to the committee. Where I missed you, it's then what then becomes our role as NCOP or as Parliament when she doesn't have financial muscle to travel wherever she is to come and account to us. And I'm agreeing with the notion that says, let us not find ourselves trapped on legal technicalities. Let's just focus on what the committee is responsible for and leave the legal part to you guys to guide us in that process when we are deviating from what we are supposed to do. Thank you.
Okay, Honourable Matamai.
Thank you, Chairperson. Nna ke bona go le bothata gore re tswelele re shebane le ntho e leng gore e mo matsogong a molao. Gobana re tswelela le ntho e mo matsogong a molao e be re morago re nka tshwetso e itseng e le gore tla re palela tshwetso eo morago ga e le gore motho a phise a ba winner case rona mebe re saedile le president o rona re saeda le ene e be o thola gore ya re ketefalela after that. Ne ke kopa gore re tloele nne yalo re tla tswelela le yone.
Okay, I'm not sure if members want a translation.
I can assist if you want me to.
Okay, please do.
You say his view is that we should allow this process to the law, we should not interfere because this matter is before the courts. It will have implications to us in case that if they succeed in court, and that we have taken a decision against, that we must proceed. His view is that we must allow it to go with the courts to finalize.
Okay, Greer.
I think, Chair, what we need to take note of is that we are sitting with a judgment, which means the court process is concluded. There may be an appeal, but there is no appeal. There's no case in court. So we can't even be arguing the issue of subject care, because there's no case in court now. But the point that we are arguing is that even if it's there, this judgment is clear in terms of the separation of powers of the three arms of government, the legislature being one of them. So I think there is that separation of powers. We won't be intruding we won't be trampling on the legal processes, even if we continue. So we shouldn't confuse this thing. We were just giving her the benefit of doubt, and we can't permanently give her the benefit of doubt and allow her to play delaying tactics. So I think that is the point that we should be taking into consideration. Thanks, Chair.
Okay, thank you. Honorable Lagis, is that a raise of a hand?
Oh,
it's a no-no. All right. We use a lot of sign language in this meeting. I think, Ms. Njikele, there's one or two things maybe you could just clarify. I think some of the questions raised were kind of dealt with, but if you feel you need to respond as well, please do so. Thanks.
Chair, on the issue of the time that you can allocate her, and of course we will leave it to the committee, our very firm advice will be that we should be seen to be acting consistently as the institution. I'm just concerned that if we give a lesser period than what the other house is giving, there may be issues of consistency. So I think in the interest of being seen to act as Parliament, we should try and make sure that it's uniform. But again, I won't take it any further than that. It's up to the committee. On the issue of legal representation, Chair, that's the issue she had raised in her court papers, that she doesn't have the resources to prepare the representations to Parliament. And as a response to that, the National Director of Public Prosecution, in the court papers, submitted the letter which they have already written to her, giving her a guarantee that they will find her appearance before the committee. So that issue is no longer an issue now. As far as we are concerned, it's resolved. But the issue that may be a problem, if they are finding her for legal representation, and yet we don't allow legal representation. I think, Chair, there is no appeal now. As we are speaking, there is no appeal.
Yes.
Even if there is an appeal, in our reading of the judgment, and I think Honorable Ngoia is spot on, that the judge seems to be saying it is not our place to stop another arm of state from doing what the law requires them to do. That seems, in my view, to be a very firm position from court, that we are not going to interfere. There is separation of power in the country. Each arm does what is required to do, unless they violate the Constitution. We will intervene only in that instance. We have not yet violated the Constitution, as far as I know. So I consider that to be a very firm view. But, Chair, I need to say this, and we need to be honest with each other in as far as this is concerned, that we expect further litigation in this matter. And I'm sure once they receive the letter requesting them to make further representation or representation, they are likely to write back and say, but we are appealing. If we say to them, no, we are proceeding regardless of your appeal, there is likely to be another application to stop us, which in my view is not going to be helpful in view of what the judge has already said, that they are not going to interfere. But that is not going to stop somebody who's determined and who is fighting for her life, because this is a matter of life and death for the incumbents who have been removed from office. So every strategy is going to be used to try and drag this matter as far as possible. So I just thought I should put that out there, that we expect further litigation and means and ways of trying to drag it as far as it is possible. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you for the responses. I think all members, you've said a mouthful on this matter, and I think in terms of our responsibility to expedite this matter, and has been said, to deal with what is in front of us, as opposed to what may happen legally, we would then allow Ms. Jiba the 7 days to make representation to the committee, and following that, we'll then take this process forward. On that note, all members, I close this meeting. I close this session of the meeting. Thank you. I think we can, Ms. Njikele and Ganga. Yeah, you're welcome to leave or have something on your way out as well. Thank you. The honourable members, we're going to move on to the briefing on the draft notice on the firearms amnesty. Honourable members will remember in our previous meeting with the department, I can't recall the date we met them, but we sent the department away after raising various issues on the firearm amnesty application we received. And we said to the department that they needed to come back to us when they were ready, and they should also come with the minister. So the department has responded to the issues we have raised. I'm sure you've received the documentation in on your emails. I don't know if it's here. Yeah, it's also here in your pack. But in addition to that, I don't know if honourable members also had time to go through the revised presentation that they're going to be making to us. They've also made some amendments to their presentation, I think, and some of it is also in light of the questions that were asked. Today, we're just preparing ourselves for tomorrow's meeting, and I think Anthea will just take us through what we received. So that as we engage with the department tomorrow, we will be clued up in terms of what they submitted.
Morning, honourable members. As Chair mentioned, so we had met with the Department of Police on the 11th of September, and if members recall, you had given them a long list of various issues to attend to. So I'm just merely going to go through the reply that we received, and then also just highlight some new slides that they've inserted into the presentation which they'll be making tomorrow, and which members might want to take note of, just in terms of asking the department some further questions for that briefing. So there was a question from members around people who are still in possession of the old green card licenses and who are 1 month late in renewing the licenses, what would happen. And SAPS's response was that in terms of the interim order of 2009, green licenses are still valid and are not subjected to renewal. There was also a concern raised around a truckload of firearms that was stolen during the previous amnesty.
Well, members, it's this document that's written, Firearms Amnesty 2019. Unfortunately, like we said earlier, there's a technical hitch with the overhead projector. So, members, I'm just requesting maybe if you could use your documents in this instance.
Thanks. Thank you. So, as I was mentioning, one of the members had raised that there was a truckload of firearms that was stolen during the previous amnesty, and what will be done to ensure that the public trust is restored in SAPS. The response to this was twofold. They said they have no knowledge of the truckload of firearms that was stolen. However, with the Prince Lou matter, firearms were stolen from a storage facility under the control of SAPS. And the member has since been convicted and found guilty and received an 18-year prison sentence. As far as public trust is concerned, they say that they've established through this has been established through community police forums and developing and implementing community policing strategies and anti-corruption strategies. Sorry, moving along, so the mistakes from the previous amnesty, what did SAPS learn and what will be done differently this time? The response, they've done a risk assessment of risks linked to this incident, and they've changed the process in such a way that there's no stockpiling of firearms for long periods. One of the main risks identified for the Prinsloo case is that all functions were decentralized to the provinces. The revised process makes provision for an integrated auditing process between the national firearms compliance and the provincial FLASH. So FLASH is firearms, liquor and second-hand goods control. And the FLASH department of the SAPS ensures compliance and enforcement of firearm, liquor and second-hand goods control legislation. Then there were also questions raised in respect of the Central Firearms Registry, which members have said had many challenges, and how will these challenges affect the firearm amnesty. The response from SAPS is the current challenge would be the turnaround time for firearm licensing due to the resource constraints. However, special processes and dedicated task teams will be put in place for applications that are handed in by a person that wants to apply for licensing in respect of such firearms. What effect will the moratorium as a result of the pending court case appeal have on the amnesty? And also the concern was raised that only law-abiding citizens will hand in their firearms and not criminals. There is no moratorium placed on amnesty. If the moratorium relates to the South African Hunters case, the position is that the current amnesty will not be affected by the pending appeal case. The court judgment in the South African Hunters case relates only to the firearm owners who failed to renew firearms licenses. The current amnesty will include all firearm owners, be they in legal or illegal possession of their firearms, and the intention is with the current amnesty is not to target firearm owners who fail to renew their firearm licenses, but it's to reach out to as many firearm owners as possible. However, they also indicate that firearm owners who fail to renew their firearm licenses may also make use of the amnesty if they wish to. Litigation in terms of this act is contained in slide 10 of the SAPS presentation. That's a new slide that's been inserted in tomorrow's presentation document, which is this document dated the 30th of October, which I'm referring to. So in slide 10, they explain, they do a breakdown of the case law for each case. In that slide, they talk about the South African Hunters and Game Association case, and then the Gun Owners Association case. And then they basically say that there was never a stage where the minister was interdicted by any court in the Republic from proclaiming an amnesty in the slide. Okay, in terms of the loopholes in the Firearms Control Act, it was recommended that this should first be closed before an amnesty can be proposed. And SAPS's response was that the amendment of the Firearms Control Act is an ongoing process, and the amendment of the Act depends on changing circumstances, and there can never be a stage where one can say the amendment of the Act is complete. Clarity was also required on reference in the declaration to no amnesty for firearms used to commit crimes. And the question from the committee members was, does this mean that criminals may keep their firearms? The response was, firearms handed in for amnesty purposes are to be IVS tested, that's ballistic testing, and those that are connected or linked to the commission of crimes. Such cases will be investigated and perpetrators prosecuted. Well, all the provinces have concluded the risk assessments. Okay, at that stage we were talking about the 15th of September 2019. The time frame has now moved. The response was all provincial commissioners must have an operational plan to safeguard and transport all firearms during the amnesty period. Now, what is interesting, members, is that they've included slide 13 into the new presentation, which lists all the stations, the number of the stations, at least just the numbers of the stations per province, which will be excluded. with the highest number of stations excluded located in the Northern Cape province, followed by Gauteng. So in Northern Cape, there's 14 stations that will be excluded, in Gauteng, 9, and in Eastern Cape, Western Cape, 5 each, and then the number is lower from there. So in tomorrow's briefing, members might want to just inquire about why it is that these stations have been identified, and particularly in respect of the numbers in the Northern Cape and Gauteng in particular. Okay, how will SACS ensure that the 9 centralized storage facilities are safe and secure? All provincial strong room facilities are compliant with existing South African National Standard 953.2 regarding strong rooms. I don't know, we possibly need to just get some clarity around that as well. What is the status of the screening and vetting of the designated amnesty officials and SACS 13 officials? The response is a total of DFOs in screening process of 789, and then they say total screening finalized 1,318, and total vetting finalized 109. That's the response. Have SAPS members been trained to correctly complete the SAPS? Okay, so the SAPS 522 subsection A is the surrendering of firearms item form, and B, which is the forfeiture of firearms item form. This was the question from members. The response, a workshop was conducted during 2018, and a refresher workshop on the 12th of September 2019 will be rolled out at that stage to the provinces with supporting evidence of all members in the provinces trained from the 16th to 20th of September. We might want to follow up on whether this has been attended and how many people have actually been trained in this regard. Has the inquiry desk at the CFR, that's the Central Firearms Registry, been established, and how will it be able to function in a building that is not secure? Bearing in mind that this question was raised in the committee meeting, taking into account that the Portfolio Committee on Police in the previous parliament had visited the Central Firearms Registry and found it to be in particularly poor condition. The response was accommodation at the CFR is still a problem. However, it does not hamper the functions of the inquiry desk, which has been established and is in operation since 2015. Members might want to interrogate what the current problems are around that accommodation at the CFR. In terms of planning versus implementation, has the planning been finalized? Response. A plan has been compiled which addresses the before, during, and after phases of the amnesty. Now, in terms of their presentation, which they're presenting tomorrow, they developed a 5-phase plan, which is set out as follows in the presentation. Phase 1, the planning phase, contained from slides 12 to 16 of the presentation. Phase 2, the implementation plan, slide 17, which also looks at an approved communication plan. There's not much detail given in the actual presentation on that. Phase 3, reporting and monitoring, slide 18. Then they look at the destruction of firearms on slide 19, and then a debriefing phase 5 in slide 20. Clarity was sought with regard to the part of the tabling letter, which read, an application contemplated in terms of section 139, subsection 4 of the said Act shall not apply to illegal firearms with documentary proof of previous ownership cannot be produced. In terms of section 1394, this is the response. A person who hands in a firearm during amnesty may apply for a firearm license in respect of that firearm. The section covers those who can prove legal ownership in respect of such firearm, or can prove that the firearm in question belongs to any of the family members who are deceased. The section in the letter means that any person who does not fall in the above categories may not apply for licensing of such firearm. What were the administrative delays that prevented the amnesty from taking place in 2017? A response, very short, the replacement of ministers caused the delay. A concern was raised that not even the committee members were aware of the date of the proposed amnesty and how would ordinary citizens be informed. The response, the approval must be obtained from Parliament before the community can be engaged. However, the communication plan has been developed and will be rolled out upon approval. Once again, we should inquire about the communication plan. A committee member mentioned that he had lost his firearm license and had tried to obtain a duplicate without success. How would the amnesty affect people who were lawfully in possession of firearms but had lost their firearm licenses? in terms of Section 29 of the Firearms Control Act, the holder of the license must inform the registrar of such a loss. If a firearm license holder loses his or her firearm license, an application must be made for the issuing of a duplicate license. This process will not affect the amnesty processes. Question was asked around the risks and mitigation. They were very serious, in particular the condition and the safety of police stations. Police stations may become the target of robberies. The response, minimum safety standards in terms of the police safety strategy has been developed and implemented. These standards include the deployment of resources as well as access to police stations. Over and above this is a national instruction 17 of 2019 access control, which was approved and implemented. Stations that have been attacked and where firearms were stolen will be excluded from the amnesty. The next question, a similar response because it also relates to safety. So it was once again, the question was around security guards who are safeguarding the police station. Will SAPS be able to guarantee the safety of the firearms which are then handed in at the police station? Similarly, they respond around this national instruction, but they also say for the safety of firearms, a criteria for the safekeeping of firearms was developed, and assessments are being conducted by cluster commanders to ensure compliance. The question was also asked around the successes and achievements of the previous amnesty. This is contained in slide 8 of the presentation, which they're giving tomorrow. So they look in that slide, they talk about the surrendering of, at least in the response, they talk about surrendering of illegal firearms and ammunition, a total of 11,887 illegal firearms and a total of 139,234 rounds of ammunition have been surrendered. Voluntary handing in of illegal firearms and ammunition, a total of 30,442 firearms and a total of 321,155 rounds of ammunition have been handed in. Inquiries received at the National Firearms Call Center, a total of 3,873 telephonic inquiries pertaining to amnesty have been received for the above period. Slide 9 of the SAPS presentation regarding the total number of firearms destructed. So according to that slide, in 2010, 167,240 firearms were destructed, which shows a marked increase from 2009, during which year only 111,491 firearms were destructed. Before the amnesty can take place, all the stakeholders must be involved. Response, in terms of Section 139 of the Act, the declaration of amnesty is the responsibility of the Minister of Police and is not obliged to consult with stakeholders before following the legislative processes. Once again, it goes back to them saying that we need to approve the amnesty as a committee and then they'll go ahead with the communication strategy. Then they give short answers. Will the communication regarding the amnesty be centralized? Yes. The integrity of SAPS officials was also a concern. Reference was made to raids in Johannesburg where SAPS officials were found to be stealing confiscated goods. They responded that members have been identified through SAPS intelligence and as it was part of the risk identified as part of the operation and this was mitigated. After having been identified, steps have been taken against those implicated. SAPS also do have an integrity management and anti-corruption strategy in place. Will the amnesty start on the same date across the whole of South Africa? The reply was yes. Is the SAPS ready for this exercise to start? Okay, at that time it was the 1st of October, now it will be later. Taking into consideration all the challenges at the police stations, yes. They said that is a risk plan in place. Members, that concludes SAPS's responses to the questions on amnesty. Thank you.
Thank you, Anthea. Our members, these are our questions that we asked in the previous meeting. I think the intention of this briefing was so that we get up to speed with the responses from SAPS. There are other areas which Anthea has also highlighted which we could do follow-ups, but given that they are our questions, obviously we will do our follow-ups after SAPS makes their presentation. I would imagine they would elaborate on certain areas as they make their presentation. So this is just for your information. Honourable Mikolakis wants to say something. Is there any other member? Okay, Honourable Mikolakis.
Thank you, Chair. because we're going to get SAPS tomorrow, I'm not going to elaborate on all my comments and so on, because there are a few things that I'm worried about. But I do have one point that is right at the last point that was made, and that is that SAPS says that they have a risk plan in place.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't seen that risk plan. Mm-hmm. Can we request them to perhaps forward it to us so that we can have it tomorrow? I just also want to... they also say that there are certain criteria that they've put in place in terms of the safekeeping of the firearms. We don't know what that criteria is. And when I look at some of the things, for example, they say public trust has been restored, and they acknowledge there's a resource, a lack of resources, and that the station commanders still have to make sure that... It seems to me, and this is why I want this documentation, it seems to me as if it's a bit of a rush job, and everything might not be in place. And before I can actually properly consider voting, and I'm sure the rest of the members as well, voting in favour of such a thing, I need to make absolutely sure that these firearms are not going to end up in the hands of criminals. So if we can get that documentation that they refer to, not just the answers, but if they refer to certain things being in place, a certain plan, certain requirements, certain strategies, we need to know what they are and how prepared they are to actually implement it. Because from the responses that I get, it's not only a question of having a plan on paper, they also need to come and tell us exactly how prepared they are to implement what is on paper as well, if we can request that from them for tomorrow. Thank you, Chair.
No, thank you for that, Honourable Mikalakis. I'm sure that that will assist this process greatly. I think we'll do that immediately after this meeting and try and get whatever documentation they give us, but it doesn't preclude you from raising whatever issues you need to raise tomorrow. Okay. I think with that, we'll then move on to the presentation on the hydrographics ball. Patricia will be doing it in terms of the research report that she provided us with.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon, Honourable Members. The presentation I'm going to do with you is this document. I've provided another copy of it, which is, looks like the slides are bigger and should be more clear. It's his presentation on Portfolio Committee on Defence Amendments to the Hydrographic Bill. Thank you, Chair. It would also help if members do have a copy of the bill, just to be able to see, for example, if I talk about the long title, just show members what the long title is. Now, the hydrographic bill was introduced by the Minister of Defence and Military Veterans, and it's because it deals with the office of the hydrographer, and it is a unit within the South African Navy. So that is why it was introduced by the Minister of Defence. So what the bill does is it gives, on slide 2 of my presentation, it gives recognition and legislative status to the Office of the Hydrographer, which has been in existence within the South African Navy since July 1954. South Africa is a signatory to international convention relating to the monitoring of maritime safety, and it is a member also of the International Maritime Organization and International Hydrographic Organization, which monitors and regulates safe navigation of ships and other modes of transport moving around the oceans or waterways of member states. So what the bill then does is it gives effect to South Africa's international obligations in respect of that convention. So on slide 3, the following slide, you will see that the purpose of the bill, therefore, is to establish the hydrographic office within as a unit within the South African Navy, which is the main objective of the bill. And it then provides for the appointment, duties and powers of the hydrographer, and to provide for the effective monitoring of navigation by the Hydrographic Office within the various seven as per the convention. And on the following slide, I've included a map just to show you what is meant by the various seven. You'll see on the bottom left, just below the continent of Africa, you'll see the area that South Africa is responsible for monitoring. To go back to slide three, as I said previously, the Bull aligns with Africa's domestic law with its international obligations to monitor maritime safety in terms of the United Nations International Maritime Convention. So you will see on the map that there are 21 Navarias, and South Africa is responsible for Navaria 7. And that is in terms of the convention that assigns different areas to member states that signed the convention. Then moving to slide 5, the bill isn't very long, but it's quite a technical bill. That is why the portfolio committee didn't only got two submissions on the bill, and our committee did not receive any submission. So it's really a specialized area. So the long title, if I can just show members what I mean by the long title, you can see on overleaf of the cover page, page 2 of the bill, you see on top, this is referred to as the long title, and it's basically a very high-level summary of what the bill is about. So it tells you what is covered in the bill. And I've just broken it down so that members can see what it provides for. First of all, it provides for the establishment of the Hydrographic Office and its objects, functions, and the manner in which it must be managed. It provides for the appointment and the powers of the hydrographer and the staff in the Hydrographic Office. It provides for limitation of civil liability. Now, I will discuss this in more detail, the civil liability, when I deal with the clause that covers that. And then it also deals with the way that the income of that Hydrographic Office must be dealt with, cooperation agreements, and other matters connected with its function. And then it also regulates the submission of hydrographic data and the manner in which hydrographic survey marks and copyrights may be protected. That is just a high level, without going into detail, what it's really about, but just give you an idea of what the bill is going to deal with. Now, moving on to clause one of the bill, on slide 5, most bills have a definitions clause in clause 1, and this bill is no different. I've looked at selected definitions because they speak to the function and the main objectives of the bill, which is the hydrographer. And this person, in terms of the bill, must have practiced for at least 10 years as a hydrographic surveyor. So the bill is very specific about what kind of qualifications this person must have. And then a hydrographic surveyor, the bill then says, is someone who studied and practiced science of hydrography and was registered in terms of the Geomatics Professions Act 2013. Now, this is one of the amendments that was made by the Portfolio Committee because the original bill made reference to a different act, but this is the correct act that is now referred to in the bill that is before the committee. And then it also explained what is meant by hydrographic surveying. Moving on to slide 6. These are more definitions that relate specifically to hydrography, and it tells us what is meant by hydrographic data, which is the measurement and description of the physical features of the exclusive economic zone. Now, everything that the bill deals with is underwater. So you will know that in some places that the bill doesn't specifically say sea or ocean, it says internal waters, because it also covers the rivers and the dams within South Africa. So, and it tells you, basically gives a description of what's going on beneath the water so that when ships are, or other vessels are sailing, that they don't hit maybe an underground iceberg or something like that. So the purpose of this is to safely guide vessels that are sailing, whether it's on inland waters or whether it's on the sea. And then navigational warning means a broadcast message that conveys navigational information. And in terms of the website of the Hydrographic Office, it also includes weather warnings. So if there's a cyclone or some severe storm happening at sea, that ships or other vessels must be informed about, and this would be part of the functions of the hydrographic office. Then you've seen what an avaria is, and also then the bill also refers to users. Now, the hydrographic office produces certain publications with some maps and other charts. So it sells some of these products, but then one of the submissions that was received by the portfolio committee was that a user isn't only someone who buys these products, but also people like academics and researchers and even legislators like yourself who use this information that makes use of the services provided by this office. And that is why they then defined a user to mean any person who obtains through purchase or otherwise information from or products of the hydrographic office or pays for the services of the hydrographic office. Then moving on to slide 7, clause 2, is the objects clause. It basically tells you what is the objective of the bill. And as I said before, it establishes the hydrographic office. It provides for safety of navigation in the exclusive economic zone and internal waters of South Africa. Now, the bill defines what an exclusive economic zone is under the first clause. And in terms of the bill, it means the sea beyond the territorial waters of the Republic, but within a distance of 200 nautical miles from the baseline. Now, that is very technical, and I'm sure the department would be able to give a practical example of what is meant by that. But a nautical mile is how distance is measured at sea, and nautical miles are also how distance is measured for air travel. But in this instance, obviously, because the bill is about what happens on the water, it measures that distance on the water. Then other functions, obviously, or the objects of the bill ensure that hydrographic surveying is done in accordance with internationally accepted specifications and standards. As I said, for the appointment of the hydrographer and the powers and duties of the hydrographer. Then clause 3 on slide 7 still establishes the hydrographic office as a unit within the South African Navy, and it says the seat or the location of that office will be determined by the Chief of the Navy in consultation with the hydrographer. Currently, the office is located in the Western Cape in Tukai, but as the bill, maybe when the bill comes into effect, then there might be a decision to move the seat of the office. Then moving on to slide 8. Clause 4 deals with the functions of the hydrographic office. It directs or the manner in which hydrographic data is collected and compiled. As I said, for itself to users in nautical publications and charts for safety of navigation within the exclusive economic zone and internal waters of South Africa, and it provides services to users. Ensuring hydrographic surveying is carried out in with the requirements of internationally accepted specifications and standards, and then also to maintain uniformity of nautical publications and charts in line with the International Hydrographic Organization resolutions and recommendations. It coordinates hydrographic activities, and it must also take steps to ensure that navigational warnings are communicated promptly to persons navigating in the area that South Africa is responsible for. And then this office also represents South Africa at the International Hydrographic Organization and at the International Maritime Organization on Hydrographic Matters. So it, this office or the hydrographer will then represent South Africa regionally and internationally on matters of concerning its functions. Then clause 5 on slide 9 deals with the appointments and conditions of service. The important thing to note here is that because it is within the unit it's a unit within the South African Navy, the Chief of the Navy is responsible for appointing the hydrographer. And if the hydrographer is unable for more than 1 month to perform his or her duties, then the Chief of the Navy is also responsible for appointing an acting hydrographer. And that person must be appointed from the ranks of a hydrographic surveyor, which is a person appointed within that office to assist the hydrographer in his or her functions. Now, the hydrographic surveyor and other administrative staff, they are appointed by the hydrographer himself or herself as the head of the hydrographic office. Then, of course, and then what is also important to note here is that the Defence Act, as well as this bill, when it becomes an act, it will also apply to the staff of the hydrographic office as far as their conditions of service and appointments are concerned. Then Clause 6 basically just says that the hydrographer is in charge of the hydrographic office and that he must ensure that the office carries out its duties efficiently and effectively. Clause 7 deals with the powers and duties of the hydrographer. And here is where it is not only on sea, but also from this list you will see that the hydrographer may enter at reasonable hours upon any land, seashore, enclosed place or reserve on land or ocean and internal waters within the jurisdiction of South Africa and place or erect a beacon, benchmark, reference mark, temporary flag, signal or other mark, in other words survey marks, and maintain the vicinity of where that marks were placed. Now, the hydrographer may also delegate this power to a hydrographic surveyor. I mentioned earlier that this person can also be an acting hydrographer, if so appointed by the Chief of the Navy. And then there are, this is what the hydrographer may do, and then the last bullet you will see, this is what the hydrographer must do. When he or she exercises these powers that I just mentioned, reasonable notice must be given of the intention to exercise this power or duty to the owner or the occupier of land, enclosed place or reserve on land. And he or she must get the necessary consent from the owner or occupier of that place, and he must identify himself or herself to the owner or occupier and inform them of the purpose of the visit. And at the same time, the hydrographer must minimize the damage or inconvenience caused by exercising any power or performing any duty in terms of this act. And I think here the department would be able to give you an example of when that would happen and where. Then moving on to Clause 8 on Slide 10. Clause 8 talks about the submission of hydrographic data where the hydrographer can basically compel anyone who has information that pertains to the safety of navigation in the area that South Africa is responsible for to communicate that information and submit that information. And when that person has been notified, they are compelled to do so, and failure to communicate or submit that information would be an offence. So the bill creates an offence for not adhering to the request to submit information that the person has. And if found guilty, the person can then be on conviction, be liable by a fine, or can be imprisoned for up to 6 months. Clause 9 deals with survey marks, as I mentioned before, the beacons, the flags, and other things. These are all survey marks that can be placed, but the bill makes it a condition that the hydrographer must supervise the construction or erection of any survey marks, and it must be done in a prescribed manner. And then the bill also, yeah, if anyone tampers with damages or removes a survey mark, it is an offence. And again, the person is liable on conviction to a fine or up to 6 months imprisonment. And then finally on Clause 9, the owner of any damaged property or any property damaged by a survey mark is entitled to compensation by the department for such damages. The department would need to explain to members when placing of a survey mark would cause damages to a person or a property of someone that the department would be liable to pay damages for. Then clause 10 deals with archiving. Basically what this clause states is that our doctor, being in control of that office, is responsible for proper management, control and care of the information that that office is responsible for, and that the chief of the Navy then determines the minimum standards in respect of how he or she must do that, which deals with the management access to information, procedures and technological methods and risk prevention of loss, and also what to do if information is lost, and any other matter that that may require standards to be developed. And so it basically places that responsibility on the Chief of the Navy to determine the minimum standards for that office. Then moving to clause 11 on slide 11, basically it says that the product of the hydrographic office, the charge and publication, the copyright of that vests in the state, and that the hydrographer is the person that will be responsible for administering and managing the copyright pertaining to these products. Clause 12, I mentioned earlier that when the department is liable for damages if it is caused, for example, by a survey mark that damaged the property of someone in the exercise of the hydrographer's responsibilities or powers under the bill. But clause 12 limits the liability, and it says that the hydrographic office or an employee of the office is only liable for loss or damages resulting from bodily injury, loss of life, damage to property or any person or his or her dependent, if there was gross negligence or a willful act or omission relating to the use of any nautical publication or nautical charts produced and sold by the hydrographic office. So what this clause does is basically says, if all of these conditions were present, and then obviously there is they are liable, but they will not be held liable for the product of that did not come from this office. So if they use a nautical chart that was not produced by the hydrographic office, then they cannot be held liable. So that is why it limits civil liability in this clause. Then moving on to clause 13, funding for the office comes from the budget of the Department of Defense. Because it falls within the South African Navy. As I said, also the hydrographic office sells its products, its charts and publications, and income that comes from production and sale of nautical publications and charts, hydrographic services rendered by the office, and any other money to which the office is entitled, all of that income must be paid into the National Revenue Fund. Now, on the following slide, I've made some comments and put down some questions that members might want to engage the department on tomorrow. Because you can see for the period 2015-16 to 2017-18, it's quite a significant amount that the hydrographic office gets in terms of income, but it doesn't have access to that income. And the department would probably explain to us why that money goes back to the revenue fund and is not utilized by the office. But we also see that it, in earlier this year it was reported that the office would be implementing new software and that a new hydrographic survey vessel was being built. Now, you'd be interested to know that the current hydrographic ship was commissioned in 1972, so it's almost 50 years old. It's the Escutia. So it is a new one is in the process of being built, but there's no timelines that I could see in the annual report when it is expected for the new vessel to be completed. And then it was also reported that three additional survey motorboats would be manufactured and equipped to process acquired hydrographic data, and that the current hydrographic office would be refurbished and able to manage hydrographic data and produce nautical products, and that the implementation phase of this new software would also include a number of training sessions. So I've included those questions there for members' interest in the event that you would like to engage the department to get more information about how this process is unfolding. Then moving to slide 13, clause 14. The bill states that the Secretary of Defense must enter into cooperation agreements with the Director General of the Department of Transport and may enter into such agreements with other interested parties in respect of matters of joint interest that may arise from the execution of this act. And the Department of Transport, obviously, I'm talking about vessels that are moving on the water. It's a mode of transport. So that is why the Department of Transport is significant here. And then this is also something that came out from the submissions that were made in respect of how the Portfolio Committee amended the bill to make provision for cooperation agreements relating to the Office of the Hydrographer. Then clause 15 requires the hydrographer to submit a report annually to the Chief of the Navy. And then clause 16 states that the Minister may, this is now the Minister of Defense and Military Veterans, may make regulations regarding the manner in which notice must be given to occupiers and owners in respect of the exercise of powers and functions of the hydrographer, the general management of the data of that office, and as well as any other matter that need to be prescribed by the Act and that is relevant to his or her functions. Then clause 17 ensures continuity. As I mentioned earlier, this office is currently existing within the South African Navy. So what clause 17 basically states is that the current hydrographer and the staff in that office will be deemed to have been appointed in terms of this Act when the bill is enacted. So they will continue, so there won't be another appointment phase that must be undertaken. And then it also says that any action that was taken prior to this Act coming into effect will be regarded as having been done in terms of this Act. Then the last clause, clause 18, is just a short title. You will note that the date there is still 2018, and I suspect that the department will probably come tomorrow and ask you ask the committee to propose an amendment to change the date, maybe to 2019. Because the bill was originally introduced in 2018. Then the following slides is basically dealing with the submissions and the process that was followed by the Portfolio Committee. As I said, only two submissions were received, and our committee did not receive any submissions. And then I've included the last few slides. It's the same table that is in the research document that I've put on the slides for you. And this is just so that you can have an idea. When you look at the bill and you do the clause-by-clause discussion of the bill, you can see how the clauses changed in terms of what was proposed and how the department has amended it. So I'm not going to go through that because most of it has been dealt with as I went through the clauses when I discussed that earlier. And then just to conclude, this is a Section 75 bill, which means the committee can make proposals for amendments, which must, if the committee so decides to do that, it will then go back to the National Assembly and the National Assembly Committee that dealt with the bill previously. If there are no amendments and the NGOP passes the bill, then the bill will be passed and it doesn't go back to the NGOP. Thank you, Chairperson. That's my presentation.
Thank you very much, Patricia. Okay, our members, as I said earlier, this was in our preparation for tomorrow's meeting, just so that we try and get up to speed with the content of the bill. I think Patricia has also taken us through the process of what the Portfolio Committee also received as submissions and how it affected the amendments to the bill. Do you want to ask any clarity-seeking questions? Although I would prefer that you also reserve some of the clarity-seeking questions for the department tomorrow, given some technical nature or technical concepts, especially within the bill. But Honourable Matama, I think
I see on this bill, English on this. I think there's a lot of problem when you use
the military veterans on instead of using the Navy, because you include the military veteran on this bill and you know exactly military veteran. We forget about the military veteran. We benefit nothing from the TNV. So I will see it tomorrow, because they benefit nothing.
I think that's another issue, Honorable Matama, which I think as a committee we're also looking into. The unfortunate thing is that we haven't had a chance to meet with the Department of Defense, but we're working on it and trying to slot it into our program. But this bill is from the Department of Defense and military veterans.
Okay.
Any other? Can we agree, Honourable Members, that we'll tomorrow, as we meet with the department, we'll raise any other issue that we have, especially to clarify.
Yes,
Honourable Members, we're going to the last item, which is around the adoption of our minutes. You should have received quite a few minutes, so we haven't had time to adopt these. In terms of the agenda, we're going to first deal with the first set of minutes is dated the 31st of July 2019. I remember the date is on the top of the minutes, 31st of July 2019. Unfortunately, it was not in that order, or the one I received. It should be the first one on your pack of minutes. Essentially, it was the meeting where we received reports from the Department of Justice, SEPS and IPED in terms of their APP and budget. And, the 31st of July. Okay, members have it. I'm not sure if you had time to go through the minutes, or members. I know it was emailed. Some of it was emailed some time ago. Others came later. But if we can go page by page, I'll give you a few seconds just to look at the page as well. Page one, I think in terms of attendance, I would imagine it's correct. There's page two where we did adoption of reports, minutes. We also presented the draft second term program of the committee. And we received presentations on the legacy report of the First Parliament. That's on page two. On page three, it's a continuation of that. Okay, there was presentations by the research unit as well. And obviously it was basically presentations on all of our legacy reports in terms of all the portfolios that we oversee. Any comments, additions, honourable members, or any mover? I think we have no additions to make, no comments to make. Is there any mover for the minutes of the Honourable Goia, 31st of July 2019? Any seconder?
I move.
Thank you, Honourable Goia. Any seconder for the minutes? You are not present. No, Honourable Mpayela, thank you very much. Remember, the second set of minutes is dated the 20th of August.
The one single page.
Yeah, thank you. Yes, it's a single page. I think it was in relation to the previous briefing we received by the legal advisor on the Jiba court application. There's just two pages to this minute. Are there any comments or additions to the minutes? Any additions? Okay, can I get the mover for the adoption? Honorable Mwala, Honorable Mpayela seconds. Thank you, honorable members. We're moving then to the third set of minutes, which is dated the 4th of September. Remember, it's 3 pages. I have multiple copies. Remember, is it 4? Yes, 4 pages. It was the meeting where we were briefed by the Magistrates Commission on the progress report for the 4 magistrates. Remember. Yeah, I don't know if you recall.
4th of September?
Yes. It was on the 4th of September. Do you all have copies?
Oh, what's the commission
yes.
now?
Yes. Okay, honourable members, any amendment to these minutes?
No.
I can get a mover on one Mwala, a second on one Nita. Thank you, members. The next set of minutes is dated the 11th of September. It's also 4 pages. The minutes relate to the previous briefing we received from SAPS on the declaration of amnesty. Also, we dealt with the iPad bill at that time in terms of just receiving an initial briefing. On members, any additions to the minutes? Okay. Can I get a mover, Honorable Mwala? And Honorable Goyer? Thank you, honourable members. The next one is the 8th of
October.
October 10th. Yes. 8th of October, 3 pages. The meeting was one of our internal briefings around the Cybercrimes Bill, the Civil Union Amendment, the Child Justice Amendment Bill, and the Traditional Courts Bill. It was an internal briefing from our research, etc. Okay, can any mover for the adoption of these minutes? Honorable Fayela, second Honorable Mola, thank you, honorable members. And then the last is dated the 9th of October. Okay, the second last. Apologies for that, honorable members. I think it was just an oversight. We didn't include the 18th. But on members, on the 9th of October,
yes,
we received a briefing by the Department of Justice on the Traditional Court Bill, mm-hmm, on the Child Justice Bill, and on the Cybercrime Bill.
Mm-hmm.
If on members recall, okay. So on members, any mover for that? Any additions, firstly, or corrections? Any mover for the adoption of the minutes? Honorable Mola, seconded by Honorable Nita. And the final set of minutes, honorable members, is the 18th of October, where we received a briefing by the Department of Home Affairs and the Border Management Authority Bill, as well as the briefing by the Parliamentary Legal Advisor on the Civil Union Amendment Bill. Sorry? 9th of October, are we dealt with that one now? Was there any amendment, Honorable Paya? Are you okay? All right. We're on the 18th of October now. And my apologies for so many minutes. I think you'll understand we've been We've been dealing with many other processes. On the 18th of October, any additions or corrections to the minutes, honourable members? If none, if I can get a mover for the adoption of the minutes, honourable Mola, and any seconder, honourable Bayela. Thank you, honourable members. I think we've come to the end of the minutes, adoption of minutes. And we've also, and thank you for your participation in this meeting and attendance, and I think we've come also to now to the end of this meeting. Tomorrow's meeting starts at 0900 hours in the morning. Honourable Nita, I understood that your committee was not sitting, but you did clarify me. It's not sitting. So we're taking advantage of the fact that the petitions committee wasn't sitting, so we're starting at 9 o'clock. Okay, thank you, members. We're sitting at 9 o'clock. Petitions not sitting, but justice, we moved our time to 9. Thank you, members. The venue, no. The venue.